This part of our segment is called What Agencies Are Doing Now, and I'm going to think that we're going to go in the order of what the outline is. So let's talk about efforts to reduce and end homelessness. Again, Steve Hollis and Katie Burnham Wilkins will be our speakers on this.
Thank you. So this community should be very proud of the work we're doing to end homelessness, and we're very serious about ending homelessness, or at least achieving what we call a functional zero level of homelessness, meaning when somebody is ready to be housed, that we have shelter and housing available. We do have some serious challenges, but we are coordinated like almost no other small Midwestern city, I think, around this issue. We've got healthcare providers, social service providers, government agencies, the VA hospital, all partnering to a level that my close friend and, as I would call her, wing woman, Katie Wilkins, is really working on to create a by-name list and through our functional zero task force. What we do behind the scenes is try to weave the very complex web of resources it takes to address homelessness. And we are doing that with the simple idea that the solution to homelessness is a home. We are using a housing first model, and we are saying that we're going to end homelessness by putting people in a home. Of course, that takes affordable housing and health care and case management. So we're working on those things, and we're really trying to gain as much efficiency out of our resource scarce environment as we can. I'm going to turn it over to Katie to talk about some details.
Well, good evening. I am Katie Burnham Wilkins. I coordinate the Homeless Veteran Program at the VA, but I also have the privilege of facilitating our Homeless Task Force and our Street Outreach team in our community. So I wanted to just kind of share with you brief information about both projects because we're really excited about them and very proud of the projects. The first I'm going to talk about is our Functional Zero Task Force, which is our homeless task force. And the real goal is for us to end and reduce veteran and chronic homelessness in this community. So we're trying to use some proven strategies to do that work. So we're coordinating efforts in a different way, in a way that we haven't done before. We have 15 agencies that are part of the task force. In addition, we are looking to expand our already really positive, strong relationships with law enforcement and the emergency room staff at University and Boone Hospital. So we use a triage tool to assess our clients, and it's really a tool that assesses chronicity of homelessness and medical vulnerability, and it tells us what a person's risk of dying on the street is. And that information allows us to make decisions about how we are utilizing resources and allows us to prioritize resources for people who are the most vulnerable in the community. And it also allows us to have a common language as providers to talk about the acuity of our patients, which we haven't had before. In addition, we really wanted to know, you know, what's the true data on the homeless population in our community? So if you have a problem, but you don't know what the problem is, how do you solve the problem? So we've been creating what's called a by-name list. It's a first and last name list of people who are experiencing homelessness in this community. And then we use that list. We meet on the second and fourth Monday of every month. All 15 agencies sit and meet, and we case conference. So we go through the by-name list, and our goal is to get people off that list as quickly as we can and get them housed. So when we case conference, we sit and we staff through the kind of top chunk of the list, and we're trying to just problem solve barriers and solutions, create solutions and discuss resources that are available. You know, if we have someone that's been on the list for a few months and, you know, it's like, what's going on? Why are we slow at getting this person housed? Maybe there's a landlord that another agency knows of that would be a good fit for that particular, you know, legal history that this client has. So it's just a really different kind of coordinated way of approaching the issue. And then again, the by name list allows us to have real time data on the people who are experiencing homelessness in this community. We started tracking data in February of 2016, and we have been able to house 211 individuals and families since then, which we're tremendously proud of. And we're also tremendously proud to know that number, because in the past, each agency knew that information for their particular agency, but we did not know that as a community as a whole. In addition to the task force, we have a coordinated street outreach team. That team members are Rural Behavioral Health, the Columbia Police Department, New Horizons, Phoenix Health Programs, Rainbow House's Homeless Youth Program, and the VA. Additionally, we frequently consult with Rosanna and Andrew, who are the park rangers for the city. And our goal is really to know our unsheltered homeless population by face and by name. So when we're in the community, we want to know who these people are, we want to know that we're engaging them, and we want to know that we're doing our best to build rapport and try to engage them in getting housed. As Steve said, we know the best solution to homelessness is housing people. So our unsheltered people, you know, sometimes it can take a while to build that relationship. And that's what we're trying to do. So we coordinate every week. We have a rotating schedule of staff that go to Turning Point, which is our drop-in center. And then additionally on Fridays, we go out into the camps and we go into the parks and we come downtown. And, you know, sometimes we follow up on leads that we've gotten from the community. Sometimes Steve's department, sometimes law enforcement has alerted us to a client that they're concerned about. And so we want to go check on them and start to build that relationship and engage them in case management. And ultimately the goal is to get people housed. I'm going to pass it on.
Turn our attention to the faith community now, Rocky Alden and Carla Williams.
Good evening. My name is Rocky Alden, and I'm going to share with you what our faith community is currently doing in regards to serving the homeless population. The first emergency overnight shelter began in December of 2009 when a group of pastors downtown noticed some individuals without housing and were worried for their outcome over the cold winter nights. So they started a shelter which lasted about 10 days through the bitter cold. And in January of 2010, intentional meetings started happening and Room at the Inn, the overnight shelter, began. Today, it's a collaboration of over 40 churches. We also have a number of other organizations in our community and individuals in our community that work together to provide overnight shelter during the months of December, January, February, and March. The location moves between 5 to 6 different churches each season, and so our typical stay at one church is about 2 to 3 weeks. RADI is open to adult males and females, anyone over the age of 18. We are what is considered a low barrier shelter, so we will take people as they come to us. We're pretty open. We hold about 50 to 55 individuals each night, and our average is about 45 folks per night. And although we can accommodate almost everybody most nights, when it is bitter cold, our demand goes up. And sometimes on the worst case scenario weather, we do have to turn folks away. Ways in which our community can be involved. If you're here tonight and you're thinking, I might want to participate. There are lots of ways that our community, and we are very fortunate, as Steve has said, in our community with resources and individuals willing to help. RADI operates through financial and in-kind donation. We also need folks to staff one of the 4 shifts we have every day, starting in the evening and running through the morning. It takes us about 500 different volunteers each season to staff those shifts. So that just gives you an idea of the breadth of our work. We also need people that do laundry for our bedding. We need people that drive vans when our shelters are outside of the downtown area. And we also need people on the planning committee that meet when we're not housing folks. So it's a pretty expansive network, and it wouldn't exist without our community's generosity.
And excuse me, I'm Carla Williams. I am with Heart of Missouri United Way, but I'm a board member for the Columbia Alliance to Combat Homelessness, which operates Room at the Inn, and I'm on the Functional Zero Task Force. So Room at the Inn is the largest faith-based collaboration. There are others in our community. Turning Point, as Katie mentioned, the day center is at Wilkes Boulevard United Methodist Church. It provides daily basic needs, a shower, laundry, a mailing address for folks to receive mail, personal storage, and computer use. They are open Monday through Friday, 8 to noon, and Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 5 to 6. So there are limited hours, but there are places for people to go to take care of what they need. There is also a Saturday cafe that is operated at the downtown churches every Saturday all year long for folks to get food, to socialize, to have a place to go during the day. Another place to eat is Loaves and Fishes, and that is also operated out of Wilkes Boulevard United Methodist Church. It is run through the St. Francis Catholic Worker Organization. And then Love, Inc. deals with people transitioning into housing. It's not a directly homeless shelter, but it deals with people trying to get into housing. All of these organizations see a number of people who are just chronically on the street.
So we'll move back to talking about housing now, and Phil Steinhaus again.
Thank you. So what are we doing now? The Columbia Housing Authority is in the midst of renovating all 717 units of our public housing stock. By next February, we'll have renovated 509 of our 717 public housing units, with 90 more units getting started on full renovation next January. We hope to complete the final 120 over the next 3 years. This is the largest investment in affordable housing in our community since urban renewal. If you've had a chance to see what we're doing, drive out to Alita Boulevard or Bear Creek and see the renovated units out there, or drive west on Worley Street and you'll see there at Oak, or turn on Oak and drive over to Lincoln and Unity. These are beautiful units. We've completely renovated these units, and the people that have moved in really feel respected. They love these new units. One of the things we did, we brought them up to code, made them energy efficient. The affordable housing equation is rent plus utilities. We can assist with the rent, but we can't assist utilities. So if you can only afford $100, you can't afford $200 in utilities. So these are very energy efficient. One of the other things that we're done is we created Patriot Place Apartments. We had created 25 permanent apartments for homeless veterans out on the east end of the business loop. We did that with a variety of funds, from tax credits to local donations and Missouri Foundation for Health, Federal Home Loan Bank. An exciting part of that project is when we bought this old motel out on the east end of the business, we sold part of that property to Welcome Home so they could build a new shelter. So Welcome Home has kind of a very inaccessible shelter that can serve 8, 9, maybe 10 people if you let somebody sleeping on the couch and the floor. They're going to have their grand opening July 20th. They'll have 32 rooms, like a hotel room, that will be able to serve homeless veterans who are coming off the street. The idea is homeless veterans can come off the street, get emergency housing, stay there while they transition into permanent housing, get connected with the VA, who is also a partner both at Welcome Home and at Patriot Place, and then either transition into an available unit at Patriot Place or into one of our 118 Veterans Affairs supportive housing vouchers. And so we have housing vouchers where vets can then use that to rent housing out in the community, and they receive supportive services from the Truman VA. For every 25 vouchers we have, the VA gets a full-time supportive services case to work with those folks. So that's a pretty exciting program. Actually, the so effective with the VA is that we have been operating a program called Shelter Plus Care, which is now called the Continuum of Care, since about 1996. We have 65 vouchers for homeless persons with disabilities. We have a partnership with the agency. So, for example, New Horizons finds someone who's homeless with disability. They bring them to us. We issue them a voucher. They help them find housing, and then they provide supportive services in order to keep that person in housing. And that's critical. To solve this problem, you have to have housing and supportive services. And we can talk about the housing first model, but it does not work if you put somebody in housing, but then you just walk away. So we kind of have a saying, you know, no drive-bys at the housing authority. You bring somebody by, you better be prepared to support them and help them be successful. So, and that's what we've done, agency partnerships for supportive housing, and we also have what we call service-enriched housing. So some people direct services, other people just need access to a services. And so those of you that know me, I wasn't a housing guy when I took this job. I was a social services guy, but I knew the wealth of health and human services in our community. I also recognized not doing enough to connect housing with social services. And so that's kind of been my mission at the Housing Authority. We have a nonprofit that has a budget of over $1 million that provides a lot of different services to help people become self-sufficient or live as independently as possible.
All right. Well, again, we're talking about what agencies are doing now and the problem of the mental health crisis and need for solutions under CIT. We welcome Deputy Tracy Cleeton.
I'm an enforcement sergeant with the Boone County Sheriff's Department, and I also am the CIT coordinator for our department. I sit on a local council. It's the Mid-Missouri CIT Council. We have numerous agencies that sit on there with us. Mental health professionals are on it, treatment centers, support groups, hospitals, the legal system, and a lot of surrounding agencies sit on this council. What we do is we host an annual training. It's 40-hour training. It's offered once a year right now. We're going to open it up to twice a year because it's so big. We're getting so many officers. Last year, we had nearly 50 students with 15 agencies represented. It's fantastic training. It's some of the best training that I've had. Typically, we have 25 different subjects, and they range from de-escalation skills, overview of mental illness, PTSD, tactical communication, addiction, depression, autism, codependency type things. So we seek out professionals in the community. They volunteer their time, and they come and instruct officers. So it's open to the public. Ms. Thompson's been to it. Huge supporter, as is Rusty. So what does it do? It offers and teaches us ways to de-escalate situations. We are often the first people to encounter somebody having a crisis, having the worst day of their life, and we're expected to fix it within 5 or 10 minutes and go on to the next call that's sitting in the stack. So we have typically calls waiting on us. It's just get them out real quick, but that's what's happened. So what we've seen is we're dealing with the same people and the same issues all the time. We can't keep just taking them and putting a Band-Aid on them and taking them to the hospital or taking them to jail. We can't keep doing that. And jail is not often the best place. So if it's not a law enforcement issue, then we know how to get services involved. We have a community mental health liaison. She's a CMHL, we call her. Anna White, locally, fantastic. So she's the link between law enforcement contacts and mental health professionals. So she kind of picks up where we leave off. We can make referrals. If it's not a law enforcement issue, we can make a referral. So this liaison will go and make a home visit, she can. We can take her places. People meet with her. So she discusses services with them. She's out of Burl, and she can get them in touch with Medicus, family members, and kind of bring everybody to the table. And that's really what it is. It's a collaboration of everybody in the community working together to kind of achieve a common goal. We, too, have somewhat of a saying at the Sheriff's Department that we leave people better than when we found them. So, and that's not easy to do, as you know. Like I said, partner with the Columbia Police Department. We brought this to Central Missouri. It originated in Kansas City. St. Louis picked it up next, and then Columbia Police Department, as well as Boone County Sheriff's Department, brought it locally. We have University of Missouri PD, the University Hospital, Ashland Hallsville, the Boone County Courthouse Marshals are on board, and then we've also brought like Howard County, Cooper County, Booneville, and other agencies to the table. So it's big training. We're training everybody. Everybody's welcome to it. We recently had CIT for dispatchers. That was a huge success. We were going to cap it at 25, but we got 50 within weeks. And again, Ms. Thompson's a huge supporter for that. Great training. I think it was pretty well received. Dispatchers loved it. We do scenarios at the end where students who have attended the course can kind of work through and de-escalate situations using the skills that they learned and how to, talk people. And ultimately, as we know, sometimes it is necessary to take people into custody, into the jail, but we're trying to get away from that. It's the diversion. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Now let's hear about community policing. And I think that's Jeff Jones down there to talk about that. Hi.
So about 2 years ago, to build off of what Tracy said, the Columbia Police Department recognized that we were going to a lot of calls with the same people. We weren't very effective in that because it was cyclical and we didn't see any real result other than our call volume continued to go up, our resources continued to go down, and there was really no place to house them. We dealt with everything as a law enforcement issue, and when we took a step back, we realized that a lot of the things, probably 80 to 90% of the things that we were responding to were not really law enforcement related at all. So Sergeant Hester, who's here, and I sat down, and we came up with a mission and goals, hoping that we would have a community outreach unit. and the administration from the city and the police department blessed us with that, and we ended up with six, now eight officers in four different areas in the city. So that instead of going call to call, like Tracy talked about, we have an opportunity to go to these houses even before we get called. We go door to door a lot. We talk to the folks in that area. We build partnerships with them, as well as all of the people at this table and a lot of the people in the room. And we come up with solutions for problems so that we don't continue to come back as law enforcement. We have had a lot of success in that. I'd like to take credit for that, but I can't, because all of these people in this room have a heart for this type of activity. Ms. Thompson, I met her a couple years ago, and we went over all of the things that she and Rusty were working on, and all of it seemed to align itself. Unintentionally, part of it, part of it intentionally, but we had the opportunity to really come together and have intentional conversations and meetings and come up with real solutions. And I think that we've been really effective in that. We have a lot of growing to do, but we're working with limited resources. So the goal in the future would be to have all of our cops working in neighborhoods like we do in those four neighborhoods, but that can't be a reality until we have enough resources. So.
Thank you. We'll go to Community Mental Health Liaison, Megan Steen.
Hi, I'm Megan Steen. I'm from Borough Behavioral Health. So we are the Community Mental Health Center for Boone County. And as has been touched on several times tonight, there's more of a need for mental health services through our agency than the resources that we have at times. One of the resources that we have that was mentioned is Anna White. She's our community mental health liaison. And we were fortunate that is an initiative that was signed by Governor Nixon that provided community mental health liaisons throughout the state. And so there are 31 community mental health liaisons in the state of Missouri. So while Anna is very amazing and helps with Boone County, she also helps our other nine counties throughout this region, where at the end of the day, we could probably have two of her just for Boone County. So she is a tremendous resource, but she is a very stretched-thin resource at times. One of the other things that has been touched on this evening is the use of emergency rooms to access mental health services. That is another program, an initiative that was done by Governor Nixon, which is our ERE program. And so that is a program that really helps respond to individuals who frequently access the emergency room as their first line of care for mental health services. So we have partnerships and relationships with University Hospital, Boone Hospital, and then the federally qualified health centers to help respond and follow up with care for the individuals accessing those ERs and facilities as kind of their main line of mental health. The amazing thing with this program is that we're able to help individuals who don't have any form of insurance. So even if they don't have Medicaid or any other paid source, we're able to assist and get them linked to the appropriate care, help with that Medicaid application, and just help with accessing basic needs as well. And then one thing that I will touch on is SOAR initiative, and SOAR stands for Outreach, Access, and Recovery. This is something that Borough has been fortunate. There was an RFP that was put out through Boone County, and we were awarded to start up initiative within Boone County. And so in the next week or so, we will actually be kicking off this initiative where we will have a staff member who will be designated to assist individuals who are homeless or at risk for homelessness, who are leaving prison or jails, to assist with that SSI and SSDI application process. On average, of individuals completing that on their own, it's approved about 10 to 15% the first time. Whereas with the SOAR process, this is a national program, and there's a 67% success rate with SOAR.
Thank you. I'll just turn it over to the court responses now. I'm not sure who's going, but they'll decide right now.
Hi, I'm Mary Epping. I'm the court administrator for the 13th Circuit. That's Boone and Callaway counties. I'm going to talk about four things that the circuit court does for mental health. The first is one you may be familiar with. It's called the 552, and it's called the 552 because that's actually the statutory reference. This is when the judge orders a psychiatric evaluation for a defendant because they're concerned the defendant does not or cannot understand the proceedings against him or her and cannot assist in their own defense. This requires the Department of Mental Health to make an evaluation, and depending on what that evaluation says, the judge can make some decisions about what should happen to the person in their case. One thing that can happen is that they get referred to a mental health court. That's one of our treatment courts. And actually, some of our partners, probation and parole, are here, and they assist us with that. When someone's in mental health court, there is a team consisting of the court, community resources, PNP, and some other agencies that help that person get a handle on whatever their mental health condition is, and also help them better acclimate to just general basic living needs. It allows them to better function in society, and the goal is to prevent them from having further intervention with the criminal justice system, to stop that cycle. Another thing the court does for mental health hearings, when someone's at MUPC, we try to conduct all those hearings over video. This prohibits a patient from being handcuffed or otherwise restricted in the trauma of being transported to the court for their hearing. Instead, they stay at the hospital, they appear by video, they see the judge, and doctors also get to appear by video, so they don't have to come and sit in the court and wait for their case to be called. They can attend to their patients. The fourth thing, which is the most recent, is our mental health staffing, and actually Commissioner Thompson and Rusty helped start this and are part of this group. The staffing is led by Judge Leslie Schneider because she does family court. She doesn't hear criminal cases, so she's neutral, and these are never her cases. And it's the prosecutor, defense counsel, and the jail all come together around a table, and they talk about folks who are at the jail who the jail has identified as probably having some mental health conditions whose cases may or may not be stuck. The group talks about what's going on with that individual and tries to make sure that case is moving forward to help those individuals. Judge?
Hi, I'm Kavanaugh Nose. I'm the municipal court judge for the city of Columbia, and I took over in January from Judge Alger. And what we've started is a community support docket, and it's a pilot program where basically what we're trying to do is bring these resources that everyone else has already created and build upon that into the court system and municipal court. And what it really does is it allows for a connection point of those resources. And obviously the ultimate goal really is that if you can take positive steps on a path that doesn't return you to municipal court and it helps you at the same time, why wouldn't we do that? And so that's one of the things we're trying to accomplish. And right now we're focused on homelessness and veterans because those are the current resources that are available. But obviously if later we have more resources and we can expand that to other risk groups, certainly we'd be willing to try that too. So that's what we're doing right now.
All right, we'll move to the jail responses then, and we'll shuffle the microphone around. Again, I'm not sure who's going to speak first, but we're ready to hear about the jail response on the problem.
I'm Keith Hoskins. I'm the director of the Boone County Detention Facility. Currently, we have 224 people in our custody. Of those 224, 35 of them are being housed out of county today. And it might be just happenstance, I don't know. But currently, 18% of our population is on some type of psychotropic medication. That 18% turns out to be 36 people. So is it happenstance? I don't know. But those 36 people might have a better chance at getting better treatment if they were not in the jail. There are people that do belong in jail, don't get me wrong, but there are some people that would be better suited in a community-based treatment program.
I'm Tom Furman. I am the full-time counselor, mental health counselor at the jail. We are very fortunate to live in a forward-thinking community that has decided to hire a full-time mental health professional for the jail. Many communities do not have this luxury. We could use more professionals in the jail doing various tasks, but a word of encouragement, things are starting to, there's synergy building because this past Sunday, for instance, we had a guy that was released from jail, and Megan's ERE program, we had coordinated with one of their guys who made sure that my guy had an assessment planned at 10 a.m. on Monday morning to make sure he didn't fall between the cracks and end up going out into the community homeless, without resources, without medications. And that's the sort of operation that we optimally need to have. Right now, what I can provide in the jail is suicide assessment, suicide monitoring, one-on-one therapy on a limited basis, coping skills training for stress and anger management. But we do need more linkages for a warm handoff for when people are discharged from the jail, so that we can get them into the hands of the next level of provider, so that they don't start using again, so that they have a place to live, because the bottle or the pill may be their best friend in how to cope with losses that they've had. And we want to try to head that off at the pass, so to speak, so that we can help them be successful when they get out of jail.
All right, thank you. Then when they do, they have to reenter, so we'll hear about reentry programming. Dan Hannigan.
Yes, my name is Dan Hannigan. I work with an agency in town called Into Action. So as we reduce the jail population and the prison population in the state, the question is, then what? They come home. And we are in existence to help people successfully and permanently transition back into the community upon their release. We know that, just like Phil had mentioned, just putting a roof over somebody's head is not usually a solution. Just releasing somebody from prison is not usually a solution. We know from the recidivism rates that we have a lot of repeat customers. There's a revolving door going around. So what we do at Into Action is we provide safe, drug-free residential transition services. When people are released from incarceration, they come to us. We have 18 beds. They're not allowed to work for the first 30 days, and they go to life skills training during those first 30 days. And it's during that time we try to address what we know through the research to be some of the greatest risk factors that these individuals have when they're released from incarceration. So a couple things that we do with our men is we have emotional stability life skills, where we try to help them understand not to be making emotional decisions, how to control impulses, how to regulate their emotions. We do some decision making and cognitive restructuring during that time. And one of the things with a lot of the support from the city that we do is we have a transitional employment program. We know from state-level data that the greatest predictor for success, if we measure success by reduced recidivism rates, the greatest predictor for success among those being released from incarceration is full-time employment. What we also know is a lot of people released from jail and prison are, in a lot of ways, unemployable. They just don't have the skills, they don't have the attitude, they don't have the ethics. So we have a lawn service that we operate through Into Action, where we're able to teach men some of these most basic skills. And then when they graduate our program, we have really good success rates, not only with our men finding jobs, but keeping jobs.
Thank you. We'll come back up here to Dr. John Cummins, and he'll talk about MedZoo and behavioral health care.
Howdy. So briefly, as you can imagine, MedZoo is a product of Mizzou. It's no surprise to anyone from the community. It's the free clinic run by the medical school, and specifically by the medical students, provides care specifically to the uninsured, which is a community that, as you can imagine, tends to fall through the cracks pretty quickly. I'm the psychiatric care provider. I'm there one night a month, which is not particularly a lot of care, but again, that's all we can provide at this point. I have a huge patient panel, enormous. I also manage case management, which is a program the med students started a few years back, and I begged them to start including folks whose primary conditions were mental illness, and it's made a huge difference. We're also expanding and working with a lot of other agencies, including Room at the Inn. We've been there several times. They're fantastic and been hugely great hosts for us for when we have clinics there. I've been there only once so far. I'm looking forward to being there again. We also work with a lot of other agencies in town. That said, We have a finite amount of resources, just like every other agency on this panel and every other provider on this panel. That said, we're doing our best to meet those needs. And one of the ways we are doing it within our clinic is to go from a traditional psychiatric provider. You go see your psychiatrist, spend 30 minutes, an hour talking about your treatment, to a more consult model, which has become sort of a national push for a lot of clinics, including, as Steve might know, the Family Health Center, our public health department health provider. We're working on it, and I think that we're making a dent just like every other agency is. It's maybe a little smaller, though. Thanks.
And we'll wrap up this section of our program, Mental Health First Aid, and NAMI. Here's Tim Harlan again.
Mental health first aid is something that we brought from Australia, where they for some time have had every teacher, everyone in the fire department, everyone in the police department takes this. We have an eight-hour course so they can recognize issues with mental health. They know what to do. When do you call 911? How do you know that? How do you recognize a mental health issue? The National Alliance on Mental Illness did this in Maryland and Missouri were the first two states. They wanted to see how that would work. Now they have it in 50 states. But it's an eight-hour course. In my handout, hopefully you can navigate the internet to find the classes. I have two different places that you can do that. But it has proved to be very worthwhile. The National Alliance on Mental Illness was started in 1979 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's the largest grassroots mental health group in the country. We provide education, support, and also advocacy, both in Jefferson City and in Washington. I've described all of that in the handout, which also has the meeting times and those things. But I discovered we had someone from St. Louis that used to come down here and help coordinate things, and she said we'd have people in St. Louis who would drive to the parking lot, and they'd say, well, I've been here 3 months in a row, but I never got out of my car, because I wasn't really sure what it was going to be. Well, that's a terrible thing. So I'm going to tell you in about 15 seconds what we do. We have a program that's about an hour that is of general interest to people. A psychiatrist describing borderline personality disorder, somebody explaining this is what happens with IEPs, this is how you deal with the school, social worker talking about therapy, what should you expect from therapy when you start therapy. Then we break into two groups. One is for consumers, which is people that are consuming mental health treatment, somebody who's getting treatment. The other is a family group. Sometimes people are there with both those issues. So we say, well, what did you come for tonight? But it's about 2 minutes per person to go around the room. This is what's happening tonight, right now, and then spend about an hour talking about those things. Obviously, privacy is a huge issue, and we recognize that. But I think it's very helpful. And the thing that people realize, I think, the most is they think, I'm the only person in the world that has gone through this. And then they realize there are dozens of other people who have been through exactly the same thing. And I think that particularly is very helpful. I'm the president of that local group.